This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. An outspoken Obama advisor steps down after calling Clinton a monster. A historically black university hangs on to a major art collection worth millions of dollars, and how pop culture is shaping national elections. We'll tackle it all on our Bloggers Roundtable, and joining me now to wrap about the headlines is Kim Platt. Kim blogs at AskThisBlackWoman.com. Also, the media assassin Harry Allen, who blogs at HarryAllen.info, and Robert Redding, who publishes the Redding News Review. Hey, folks.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Bri.
So last week, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Samantha Power stepped down as Barack Obama's foreign policy advisor. She gave this interview to the Scottish newspaper, The Scotsman. She referred to Hillary Clinton as, quote, a monster. Now, Power made the comment off the record, but the reporter says it was on the record and decided to publish it anyway. Power apologized to Obama. Obama condemned the comment. Power resigned. A lot of attention to this whole thing. Robert, you've been watching this race very closely. I want to ask you not just about this case, but about advisors in general. What role do unpaid advisors, and Power was one of those unpaid advisors, play in whispering in the candidate's ear? And I don't mean that in a negative way. Someone has to whisper in their ear on all these big issues. What role do they actually play? They're not official employees of the campaign.
Well, they do play a role because they're affiliated with the campaign. Having worked in the campaign, I used to work for Michael Brown, the son of Ron Brown, Commerce Secretary under Clinton, and as his communications director. And anyone that's affiliated with the campaign is definitely a part of the candidate and his team and his philosophy. So you have to be very careful, very measured with that. So with this particular instance, I think what we're seeing is an appropriate move by Ms. Powers at this point to make sure that she doesn't damage Barack Obama. The reason why this is not a big issue and this whole ethics in journalism, because that's what is involved here, I think, first of all, the reason why it's not a big issue is because she made the comment and a lot of people agree with that comment. But besides that point, it's just negative. It's not something that he wants. But the ethics issue comes where, as a reporter, having worked at various newspapers, she said it after the fact. Now, that's off the record after she made the comment. That's not the way it works. You say something's off the record, you get the approval, and then you say it. But typically, you should never go off the record with the reporter.
Yeah, I mean, I guess part of it is also that people, there's all these protocols around what is on and what is off the record.
Right.
But in general, if you don't want it published, it's better not to say it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Kim, one of the many articles written about this pointed out that there's a difference between what you want to convey on a level of personal passion and what you can say in the world of politics. Was this just a case of her confusing those two roles?
I think that in general, this election is a very emotional one. And it seems to me that she, yes, she spoke out. She was emotional. And it was an outburst that shouldn't have happened, and she should have used more restraint.
But I think as well that this particular person is very passionate and very direct, and she has a history of that, of dealing with very harsh issues in a very straightforward way. And I think that I don't think it's out of line for her as a person, as an intellect, and as a speaker. Although clearly it was out of line because it's not the position of the Obama campaign.
Tell me more about that. When you say that it wasn't out of line for her, do you mean that basically this certainly fit in with her personal philosophy? It was just something she shouldn't have said, or?
Well, what I mean is that as I've observed her in the short time I've been able to observe her, Samantha Power she's the author of the book A Problem from Hell, which was a text on genocide, the history of genocide, and the problem of genocide, and I think first of all that as a personality that she is very direct and forthcoming and not one to mince words. And I think that that certainly served her dealing with a subject that even in her own words often no one wanted to hear about, no one wanted to talk about. And I think she brings a lot of that to anything she does. But I think that it's a knife that cuts both ways. And in a political campaign, you have to be a bit more gentle. You have to strike more decisively when you choose to strike. You can't just have it going And I think in this case, she just had it going. It wasn't the Obama style, so to speak.
Let me throw in something else. The Obama camp also uses Susan Rice as a foreign policy advisor. She recently was on MSNBC discussing Hillary Clinton's 3 a.m. red phone ad, a controversial ad about who's ready in times of trouble. TV host Tucker Carlson asked Susan Rice if the Illinois senator has ever made these tough crisis moment decisions. Here's Rice's response.
He hasn't, and he hasn't claimed that he's been in a position to have to answer the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning in a crisis situation. That's the difference between the two of them. Hillary Clinton hasn't had to answer the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning, and yet she attacked Barack Obama for not being ready. They're both not ready to have that 3 a.m. phone call.
Is that kind of not really the perfect thing you should say about your candidate? I mean, Robert, that's kind of a
wow.
It's like the double-edged sword situation.
Yeah, you don't want that kind of thing being said about your own candidate. It's one thing to say that about someone else that you're running against, but you know, is anybody ever ready to be president? She's being honest. I understand what she's saying, but at the same time, as again, I step back into that communication director role. You don't want that kind of stuff out there. And, you know, this kind of goes back to the larger issue. People continue to forget that, and, you know, I'm an independent, but Barack Obama has had a lot of experience at the state level in the state legislature. I mean, again, you're talking about someone who was the commander-in-chief's wife. Let's put this in perspective. They had just about the same amount of time in the Senate, but he has a lot of legislative experience, and that counts for something. That's one of the things that Michael Dukakis was talking about. So, and him himself having a lot of experience in the legislature, et cetera. So,
before we wrap this up, in general, it sounds like advisors really only get a lot of play if they've done something that doesn't really fall into the this was great column. It's only when they get in trouble that we hear about them. Kim, does that seem right to you?
It doesn't really seem right to me. I think that, you know, some of the policy decisions that a candidate makes or some of the great things that have come out of their campaign should be credited to the advisors that have been working with them. But again, you know, the bad publicity gets the attention. And that's, you know, pretty typical but troubling.
I want to move on to Fisk University. That college, a historically black college, boasts some stellar alums, including W.E.B. Du Bois and Nikki Giovanni, but the Nashville school is also strapped for cash. They were trying to sell valuable works by American painter Georgia O'Keeffe. That collection was estimated at more than $100 million, but a Nashville judge squashed the sales plan. Fisk is officially forbidden from selling any of the pieces. Harry, part of the deal that O'Keeffe made with Fisk when she donated the collection was that Fisk wouldn't sell the pieces and the work would remain on display. I'll talk about the display issue in a minute, but if the work now belongs to Fisk, and if Fisk really needs the money, why shouldn't the agreement with O'Keeffe be reevaluated? Should it be reevaluated at any point?
Well, that's a really good question. I have a good colleague by the name of Ray Winbush, who is now at Morgan State operating their Center for Black Studies there, but he used to be at Fisk running the Race Relations Institute, and we were talking about this subject, and he calls the deal that Charles Johnson, who was president in the 40s when the donation was made, a deal with the devil. He compares it to someone being given a brand new Rolls Royce on the condition that they could never drive it, would have to keep it in a warm garage, wash it once a month, wax it four times a year, and keep it insured. And it's a wonderful car. It's one of the most, you know, incredible marks ever made, but you can't do anything with it, and eventually starts to drain on you. And his position is that when O'Keeffe made this deal, it was really almost like what she was trying to do was irritate the New York art world, kind of like saying, I have the Stieglitz collection. I can do whatever I want with it. In fact, I'm going to give it to these black people just so you guys won't have it, just to show you what I can do. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, it's great to have, you know, one of the most valuable collections of the 20th century. But on the other hand, it's become I wouldn't say an albatross, but it's certainly become a hard thing for them to manage. And when I was speaking with Ray, he said that he felt that in the 60s or 70s, when Fisk was a bit more secure financially, they should have gone to court and said that the initial deal was made under racial duress and used that as a way of getting out of this or renegotiating the terms of the agreement.
Kim, when you hear mm-hmm. Harry outlining all of these different stipulations and the backstory of it, do you expect that at any point Fisk could go back to the table and ask for a renegotiation, or by this all playing out in court at this point, is it pretty much a done deal?
I think they should absolutely go back to court. And I was under the impression that the gift was made in two segments. And the first segment by Arthur Stieglitz was under the condition that they could never sell it. And then the second set of gifts by George O'Keefe didn't have that same stipulation. And I'm sure if they parse it apart and are in perhaps a less desperate situation, they'll have more power in court or the ability to negotiate that. But it's just, to me, it's just so troubling that this collection has become a burden for Fisk. And what if, you know, in 100 years, Fisk no longer exists? What happens to the collection? It doesn't really...
No, Santa Fe Museum gets it.
Yeah, there's definitely...
So it's just a matter of, you know, keeping it on display and having this, you know, historic black college and the students look at this artwork instead of having it be collateral or something, the ability to get money or make money from it.
But, you know, it's interesting. I think, not to interrupt you, Kim, I think that this is kind of like a metaphor for much of the state of black America, like incredible, precious gifts, but insufficient infrastructure to mm-hmm. manage them. And then those things often sometimes work against us or don't work in our favor or work for other people.
Robert, when you listen to this case, do you think that it resonates with the larger issues of how historically black colleges and universities, despite having great alums, despite having a lot of support, just don't have a lot of the time these fundamental if you think about schools like Harvard and Yale and then plenty of other schools, there are these multi-billion-dollar endowments, and things are running pretty thin for a lot of HBCUs. What could turn that around?
They are. And what needs to happen and what we have to be very cognizant of within the black community is that we need to make sure that we give back to the schools that gave so much to us. I think it's a sad day when we have schools like Fisk that are in danger, schools like FAMU that are in danger in financial status. But let me just say one of the things that is important here, race is an issue in terms of this collection, the way it was handed down. But black schools have to realize, because I've covered this extensively as a reporter, with Attorney Melvin Gibbs and the William H. Johnson case of artwork, he's been litigating for some time against people like Fisk, people like Tuskegee, people like the Smithsonian, talking about you have to follow a chain, the appropriate chain of ownership. You cannot just do what you want with this artwork when you get it. And I think there was an element of that with Fisk. They thought they could do this, and reading the agreement, they can't. There are some restrictions here. So they have to follow the letter of the law until they can get the law on their side.
I want to pop in case anyone is just tuning in to us. This is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chideya. We were just hearing from Robert Redding, who publishes the RedingNewsReview.com. Also, we've got the media assassin Harry Allen, who blogs at HarryAllen.info, and Kim Platt, who blogs at AskThisBlackWoman.com. So I will ask this black woman about pop culture and politics. You know, the pundits and the pollsters get their glory during the campaign season. So do the comedy shows, and SNL, Saturday Night Live, has taken on Clinton and Obama. A couple of weekends ago, the New York senator popped on to the Saturday Night Live set, and here she is opposite SNL's Amy Poehler, who plays Clinton on the show.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, well, thank you for coming. I love your outfit.
Well, I love your outfit.
Why, thank you.
Do you want the earrings back? Do I really laugh like that?
So it was all fun and giggles, but some people feel that SNL has actually been favoring Clinton. They've done a sketch that we talked about on the show on a previous day that basically implies that Obama has been getting a free pass from the press. What do you think, Kim? Do you think that this is a situation where SNL or other outlets could actually influence the election?
I think they can influence, because the American public is... can be influenced. And I think, you know, you said SNL is taking on Barack and Hillary. I think they're actually just taking on Barack. And this past Saturday, there was the skit where, you know, the Barack Obama has a 3 a.m. phone call, and he actually calls Hillary Clinton and asks for advice. So I think they've really come out and declared Hillary as their candidate of choice without, you know, so much as saying they are endorsing her. And they're doing it with humor, and humor is very powerful, and I think people can be influenced.
Harry, does that sound as if it's SNL has chosen sides?
I don't really think so. I think Hillary's the bigger target. I think that she's bigger and easier in a way to make fun of. And I have to admit, the thing that I found most striking while watching the sketch that you just played audio from, and I also had this reaction when I was watching her appearance on Jon Stewart's show, was for the moment I was watching her, I actually found myself liking her. Like, I just found myself, like, connecting to her. And this must have been, I guess, the way many white women felt when they saw her cry. That I actually found myself liking her just for the moment I saw her there with her timing, her humor. She seemed very natural and at ease, you know, in a way that she doesn't come off when she's, you know, I guess, spouting policy.
Robert, is there any place else that you turn? For example, The Daily Show is a news comedy hybrid. What other places do you think are really influential right now? Just a couple of them.
In terms of the mosh pit?
Yep.
Well, of course, Colbert Report. It's definitely one of the shows that's at the top of the list. So outside of that, I really don't know of many other shows because I don't even watch those. You know, for political hard edge stuff, that's why I thank God for NPR. because
And also YouTube,
right? And the mosh pit, yeah. I think they unfortunately they do follow SNL, and they think that this is where it's all originating from. But my sources, like I said, in Washington D.C., tell me that one of the reasons why we see the media picking sides and taking sides is not because SNL ran this skit and is weighing in on this election. It's because these media organizations really are hurting and are short on change to cover this race.
And Robert, can you confirm
yes.
we did not ask you for that endorsement of our services?
That's right.
All right. On that note, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roy.
We've been talking with Robert Redding, who publishes the RedingNewsReview.com. He was on the line from Radio People Studios in Monroe, Louisiana. Also, Kim Platt, who blogs at AskThisBlackWoman.com, and writer Harry Allen, who blogs at HarryAllen.info. They both joined me from our NPR studios in New York.